And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, April 2nd, 26 degrees and sunshine here in Park City and the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Tuesday to you. And after a prolonged stretch of active weather, we're going to finally settle into some calmer conditions as we go through the next few days. And it will be feeling like spring across the Wasatch back. And we're really going to ramp up that spring feeling as we go into our Wednesday and Thursday. But as for today, we'll check in with mostly sunny skies across the state, so across the Wasatch back as well, as we see a daytime high come in the seasonal 40s in Park City as we reach 47 degrees. While down in the Heber Valley, we'll likely see a daytime high in the middle 50s. An absolutely beautiful day if you want to spend some time outside. If you're heading up to the mountains today, just make sure that you have the sunglasses or the sun protection on the goggles and you'll be good to go. Then into tonight, we get mostly clear skies. The overnight lows will be heading into the mid and upper 20s throughout the Wasatch back. And then as we start to see our southerly winds increase on our Wednesday, we're going to trend even warmer than what we find out there today. Instead of being in the mid to upper 40s in Park City, we'll be mainly in the mid 50s tomorrow under mostly sunny skies. Should be a really nice day if you want to spend some time outside. Then we'll drop to the middle 30s on Wednesday night under mostly clear skies. And Thursday is likely going to be the warmest day of this week, as we actually could sneak into the upper 50s in Park City with a chance that we're talking about low to mid 60s. In the Heber Valley. But on Thursday, what's going to happen is the high pressure that's being our weather quiet today and tomorrow will continue to slide to the east. Our winds will continue to accelerate out of the south. And by Thursday, there's going to be a low pressure approaching from the west. So between the low pressure to our west, high pressure to our east, we'll see increasing clouds, we'll see increasing winds. And by Thursday night, we'll check in with partly to mostly cloudy skies with the overnight low only dropping into the upper 30s. But then that low pressure to our west will eventually move in as we go throughout the day on Friday, which will lead to a big shakeup. And we're going to be going back down on the Utah spring weather roller coaster with an 80% chance of rain and then snow showers with the daytime high on Friday coming in at 49 degrees. But once the front moves through, it'll be noticeable because by Friday nights, the overnight low will be dropping to 23 degrees with a pretty good chance for snow showers. And Saturday brings the likelihood of snow with the daytime high only coming in at 33 degrees. So not only is it going to be a weather roller coaster, it's going to be more along the lines of weather whiplash as we go from the upper 50s on Thursday to the low 30s for a daytime high on Saturday with that good chance for snow showers. On Sunday and Monday, we're likely not going to be looking at as good of a chance for snow showers, but there will be a trailing system behind the low pressure that we see on Friday and Saturday. So we'll hold on to a chance of snow showers on Sunday and a chance of rain and snow on Monday as daytime highs will begin to moderate. We should be back in the upper 30s by Sunday and the middle 40s by Monday, with the overnight lows gradually climbing back through the 20s as we move into early next week. But through the next few days, it's beautiful spring weather through the Wasatch back, and then we go back to winter mode as we go into this upcoming weekend, Leslie.
Okay, Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
What I can report is that there is a moderate avalanche danger on all aspects this morning at mid and upper elevations, where triggering a soft slab of wind-drifted snow still remains possible, and throughout the day, the strong sun and warm temperatures will cause the avalanche danger to rise to moderate at all elevations facing east, south, and west as those slopes heat up and the snow becomes wet. Dealing with wet snow is all a matter of timing. Avoid being on those damp surfaces during the warmest part of the day is your safest bet. Coming up now on the local news hour, stay tuned. I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybell. He'll have a preview of this week's county council meeting. Members of the Park City Municipal Housing Team, Rhoda Stauffer, along with Brown Seabright, discussed the city's light deed program and how residents can ensure that some homes stay affordable for the long term. And finally, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, discussing some open space issues as well as one more conservation. Good morning. Well, a Salt Lake City man who told police he was a Drug Enforcement Administration agent has been charged with felony drug possession and distribution. KPCW's Jennifer Dobner has more on that.
A Summit County Sheriff's deputy arrested Matthew Brandon Montrone, 45, just after midnight on March 27th in a Kimball Junction Bank parking lot. According to an arrest affidavit, Montrose was sitting in a car with its hazard lights flashing when spotted by the deputy. When approached, Montrose initially said he worked for the DEA, but later acknowledged he had just sold cocaine to someone at a residence nearby. A search found over 23 grams of white powder in small bags in the car and in Montrose's pockets. The substance tested positive for cocaine, the affidavit says. Charging documents show Montrose made an initial appearance in 3rd District Court last Friday and was appointed a public defender. Montrose has not yet entered a plea. A detention hearing is set for April 12th. If convicted, Montrone could spend up to 15 years in prison. A records check also found that Montrone has a history of convictions for drug possession, distribution, and firearms charges that date back to 2007. Jennifer Dobner, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a meeting preview, I have Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's first just follow up from last week's meeting with UDOT. I believe county council, or at least some county officials were there. Anything new that you heard?
I don't think there's anything all that new. We expect to be able to receive an update from UDOT at a meeting in May. But other than that, I don't have a whole lot of new information.
Okay, well, why is it taking so long? I mean, this has got to be one of the most studied projects ever.
Well, UDOT is following their typical process. Something that's not typical is there is a travel demand model that's being updated. UDOT isn't actually the keeper of this model. It's the Mountain Land Association of Governments that covers Utah, Wasatch, and Summit counties. They maintain a travel demand model that basically is a map of all of the road systems and then estimates of the travel density within certain segments of the area. UDOT uses that as an input in this process. And while they could have proceeded with the old model, they actually wanted to make sure that they have the most up-to-date information and are producing the study following that update. So I think overall we'll get a better product by them delaying this than if we were to go ahead and, you know, push forward with older information.
Yeah, so how long do you think that Mountainland Association of Governments study will take?
I hope that in the next couple months they can finish it up. UDOT will then need to take that information and incorporate it into the study. I believe that they said that the draft EIS will be produced later this year, closer to the end of this year.
Yeah, and it's already been almost a year since they released their five options. So that's just
correct. Yeah, so it'll put this whole process back about 12 months.
Mm. Okay, Deer Valley Resort taking folks back to ski its new expanded terrain. Have you had the opportunity to see what's up there?
I've not been up there when there's snow on the ground, no.
Okay, not a skier?
I do ski, just I haven't been up there to ski.
No. Okay, let's see. In terms of that, with the new, you know, hotel opening up as soon as this winter, what does that mean then? I mean, have you guys kind of forecast sales tax revenues coming in as a result of sales tickets being, or lift tickets being sold on that area, side of the mountain?
Yeah, so we have done some preliminary estimates. The indications are that by this fall, that Grand Hyatt is going to be open. So it's going to have an impact on this year's budget. It's something that we weren't expecting. We were thinking that they would maybe come in much later this year and have maybe a shorter season or something like that. So we're trying to estimate what the impact is this year. But next year, we're expecting something in the range of $500,000 to $1 million to the county's budget overall.
Okay, and that's just from sales tax, or is that going to be the increase in property tax valuation as well?
So because of the funding agreement with MIDA, most of that will come through a few different revenue sources, and their sales tax is a part of it, but they have some other unique taxes, and they're just different sales and use taxes.
Okay, including transient room tax?
Yeah, so instead of charging a transient room tax, the MIDA, that particular hotel gets charged a resort fee, which is in lieu of all other taxes, and the county gets a portion of that resort tax. It's about a 15% tax. The county receives about 2% of that 15, you know, or, you know, yeah, 2/15 of it.
Yeah. So the transient room tax, do you know what that's at? I mean, so this sounds like it might be bigger.
So the amount that we're estimating includes not just that particular sales tax. The county also receives municipal energy taxes. This is when someone buys power. There is a sales tax applied to that. So the county will be receiving that. Along with, we receive administration fees for things like the pre-certificate of occupancy fee. And there's just a whole lot of pieces to that puzzle. But it's a really significant budget impact to the county. And I think this is the realization of all of the investment that the county and MIDA have put in that has an economic benefit to really all residents of Wasatch County, and as well as the improved amenities in that part.
Okay. What's the latest with High Valley Transit? Ridership still strong?
Yeah, it's as strong as it's ever been. We're having active discussions with our council about changes we might make in the future and how we might be able to identify funding for additional services to be able to continue to offer what is, I think, a really amazing benefit to our residents.
Yeah, so at this point, should residents expect any changes for spring and summer routes?
I'm not aware of any specific changes to any of those routes. We really only have the 106 that connects. I think we are looking for maybe some long-term solutions of where maybe a park and ride would go in Wasatch County and if that links into the terminus of that 106 line.
Okay. We heard from a county council member that the county's received a lot of emails from Midway residents about the wastewater treatment ponds and the county creating an industrial protection area. What's the county's response to their concerns?
So I think the council is very interested in hearing from citizens, and this has been an issue that's been ongoing for quite some time now. There is some sewer ponds out by Midway, and they're adjacent to the Provo River. They've existed there for many decades, and I think there's been some recent concerns about maybe changes in practices or changes in outcomes of what's happening over there. So the Wasatch County Health Department got involved and was conducting their own study. And now I believe that the Utah Department of Health is involved in studying it. I think we're taking it very seriously to try and address any of those concerns. What the Agricultural and Industrial Protection Area is an effort to try to identify any areas in the county that qualify as far as either their agricultural properties or their industrial properties to protect them from nuisance lawsuits. What this does is it basically means that if someone is trying to sue someone for if an agricultural practice is a standard agricultural practice or an industrial practice is a standard industrial practice, that it provides additional protections to them. But I don't believe that it provides any protections if there were, for instance, some kind of, much major issue. Those types of things aren't really in the scope of that. So what we hope that this does is it makes sure that we have adequate protections for those important uses that we already have existing. And this extends beyond just the sewer farm, but it also balances the concerns of the public. And to be clear, there is not yet an industrial protection area approved in the county.
All right, I guess it seems to me though that the sewer ponds are the nuisance. So why would you, allow this zone to protect them instead of, making Midway figure it out and clean it up?
Well, so it covers the majority of the Heber Valley floor, this Heber Valley Special Service District. And I certainly understand why people would find maybe the smell at certain times of year to be unpleasant. But I think overall, people want sewer. They want to be able to flush their toilets and have it managed in a safe way. Those sewer ponds have been there for many decades. And to my knowledge, there have not been any changes in the practices of what they've been doing there. In fact, they've tried to improve some things, introduce some additional chemicals to try and mitigate some of the smell that is coming off there. I think what the main things that have changed is residences have increasingly been built closer and closer to that farm, those sewer ponds, excuse me. And I think that's just kind of highlighted some of the issues that have already existed previously.
So by creating that zone there in that area, for those people who are already there, I mean, it's kind of like changing the zoning. You think you're living up to a low density thing and all of a sudden the zone changes and now you have to deal with thousands of apartments. I mean, isn't that kind of the same? I mean, people bought into it based on what the zoning is.
Well, I mean, in this case, there it's specifically so that there is not change. That sewer farm has always existed there for, you know, the last 40 plus years. And that this just ensures that frivolous lawsuits would not have as much weight against those things. But I think credible concerns are still something that the council is interested in, that I know that the HVSSD board is interested in, the Midway City Council is. And there's a new general manager over there who I think is very engaged in trying to address any of the concerns that they'll have. So this isn't something that, you know, anyone's trying to ignore. What it is, I think, is trying to make sure that we handle things in the most productive way and avoid some of the more problematic, time-consuming efforts that can result from some of these other legal issues.
Okay. I saw in the meeting minutes that the council was set to go on some kind of mine tour with the Jordanelle Special Service District. What mine were you going to go visit?
So the Mayflower Mine up in the Jordanelle Basin, we operate that through the Jordanelle Special Service District as actually a water source. So this is the old mine that exists up that area, and a lot of the water that comes out of that mine is treated and then used for distribution in the system. And this is a major source for that whole Jordanelle Basin area.
Yeah. So what did you guys see in the mine? Just a lot of water?
I didn't actually go on the tour, but they went up. So the mine is, I mean, for those people who are listening that are familiar with it, there's an extensive mine network underneath that mountain between Park City and this side of Wasatch County. So what they're able to do is go in far enough to the first, there's a little station there where they have equipment and things. And so I believe it was members of the county council and some of the city council and other members of the community that were able to kind of see some of the progress there. The Jordanelle Special Service District has permanent crews that go in and make sure that the mine is structurally maintained, because the water that flows out of those mines is really important to everyone in this area.
All right. Taking a look at tomorrow's agenda, there will be a discussion about setting up PIDs, or public infrastructure districts. So why is the county doing this?
There has been a lot of discussion of late regarding, you know, development incentives that the state is offering. The state passed a bill this year, the infrastructure financing districts, and we had pre-existing this public infrastructure district policy. One of the changes that we're considering tomorrow is by tweaking it so that projects in the Jordanelle Basin would be some additional scope. So residential primary projects would be qualified for a public infrastructure district. And part of the rationale is that now with this new state code, many of these projects automatically qualify for that without any oversight or approval from the county council. And there are some differences between a public infrastructure district and an infrastructure financing district. And by having the county at the table through a public infrastructure district, we feel like we hope that we can maybe get a better product than if we aren't involved in that process at all.
Yeah, well, we know the state legislature is all about growth and development, but is this good for Wasatch County? I mean, isn't doing something like this just encourage more growth?
I think part of the change that we're considering is targeting the Jordanelle Basin, because we feel that that area of the county is where the growth, the demand for growth is, and where that growth goes in a way that it doesn't impact the Heber Valley quite as much. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is this, the financing tools don't grant additional land use approvals. The density approvals are set through an entirely different process. Those land use approvals already exist. And so what we're doing is potentially offering this tool where the county can be involved in input of how those financing things work, but also we're not increasing the density. We're not making it more dense. What we're making is what we've already told you can build, now they're able to do. And part of this is all of the just the pressures of development around the new Deer Valley expansion.
Okay. So is the county, Wasatch County, liable then for any unpaid bonds should a developer go belly up?
No, actually, that's part of the reason why public infrastructure districts were originally created, because there is a really significant barrier between what happens after the county creates it and the county's continuing finances. So If we were to borrow money as the county, that shows up on our annual financial statements. But by creating a PID and then it goes off and it exists on its own, it does not reflect on our financial statements, and there's not really a means of recourse back to the county. That's part of why we feel like it's important maybe to consider a PID instead of those infrastructure financing districts, because if these things are going to exist independent of the county, what PID allows us to do that process is have input on the creation of that entity, and then it goes on to do its thing, financing and repaying those loans. So if it's going to exist independent of us, we maybe would like some input in the creation process.
All right. Finally, the council will be considering a resolution that would not allow parking near the Crandall Point trailhead. And I guess, why wouldn't you allow parking near a trailhead?
This is actually a state park trailhead. So on the Jordanelle, on the, I guess it's the west side of the Jordanelle, there is a Crandall Point trailhead. And the state park is the one who's actually reached out to us and asked us to help facilitate this area. Part of the problem is there is a county road that leads to actually this Jordanelle Special Service District facility where the mine is. And off of that road is the connection over to the Crandall Point trailhead. What we found is that with the state parks, that people will park along that road, causing a little bit of an issue in that road there, and not park in the state park access. So by prohibiting parking in this area, what we're hoping to do is get the cars to the place that they should be, which is the actual trailhead itself, and not on the local road kind of a little bit away.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Dustin?
Not this morning, no.
All right. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Live Park City is a pilot program that will allocate $1 million of funding from Park City Municipal Corporation to purchase deed restrictions for existing homeowners as well as future homeowners. In the studio with details, I have members of the Park City Housing Team, Rhoda Stauffer, along with Brown Seabright. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
So maybe, Rhoda, you start and give us just a bit of background to this light deed program. And it was something that I think Park City had seen other resorts do successfully. Doesn't seem to have taken off here.
Right. I'm actually going to punt it to Brone because he actually established the first program, the pilot program, and I only took over recently.
All right, Brone, I'll give it to you.
Sure. So the Live Park City Light Deed Restriction Program was established by the Park City Council in 2022. And as we suggested, it's a pilot program. We borrowed it elements from it from Vail, Breckenridge, Truckee, other communities, and we needed to understand how it was going to fit in Park City, how it was going to fit under Utah law. And so it was a bit of a learning experiment to see how this program would work in this community. Like we said, we had $1 million to work with. We had to figure out what parameters would be appropriate, so we kind of took our best guess based on the data that we had and learned a lot from this initial pilot program.
All right, so can you give us the numbers of what you've seen so far?
We've had many, many applications, and of the, I think it was 18 or 19 total applications, there is a committee established. The advisory committee is community members who work in various fields, actually reviewed all of those applications and awarded, I believe we ended up with four or five awards, of which two people accepted them. So we ended up with two grants of $200,000 each. One went to a down payment assistance for someone moving into Prospector and working here locally. And the other was helping a historic old town historic property owner to do some upgrades on their property.
Okay, so I guess, I mean, what's the whole basis behind this? The city hands out money to, and the homeowner does what?
Yeah, so the idea is that in our community, the latest report says that about 67% of all the homes in Park City proper are vacant. Most of those are nightly rentals, the rest of them are second homes. And because of restrictions in state law, we have relatively few tools in how we can increase the number of homes that are used by year-round occupants. This is a type of program that helps increase neighborhood vibrancy. It helps promote full-time residency in our primary residential neighborhoods, and it helps compensate the homeowners for the difference in value that their property would have if they had those nightly rental rights associated with their property.
All right, so I guess how does that reduce nightly rentals?
So we're essentially buying down those rights from properties so that they have to be used by year-round occupants.
Right, the deed restriction itself placed on it requires that the person living there, whether it's the owner or a long-term rental, must be employed within the city limits of Park City.
And in addition to that, it also provides the opportunity for things like down payment assistance for historic homes to have structural upgrades that make these habitable places for people to live for many years.
Okay, so the long-term rental is what, over 30 days? Is that what?
I believe the minimum lease has to be 6 months.
Okay. So you still got about $960,000 in the bank for this.
$600,000 is left because we've made two grants.
$400,000. Okay, got
right.
it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so what we're trying to spend this down. Even though council has decided not to proceed beyond the pilot program, we want people to take advantage of this pool. So we could make 3 to 4 grants out of this, depending on the value of the home.
All right. So the property can continue to appreciate?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, the difference in this particular program is there are no income limits. There are no limits on the value on the property. And it is not an income-based program like the rest of our deed-restricted properties. It will always be a market unit. And so the city has right to purchase, the first right of purchase, if the owner wants to sell, and it has to be at market value.
All right. So, I mean, people really, all they're giving up then is the ability to rent their home on Airbnb.
Correct.
Is that, yeah? So why do you think so few people have applied? I mean, you said 18, 19. I guess why didn't they get accepted?
Yeah, so like we said, we had to establish parameters based on our best guess. Some of the other communities that we're looking at have different economic and housing markets where the parameters are specific to how that particular market is set up. We're a little bit different. We're next to a major metropolitan area. We have Heber. We have the rest of Summit County. So we put in some restrictions for the deed restrictions. Some of those include employment restrictions, geographic-based ones. Those, I think, appear to be maybe a little more tight than some people were anticipating, and that is something that we've looked at as a potential change to some future version of the program.
Okay. But the council hasn't approved a future program, so you're really, yes. It sounds like you're just trying to get this other $600,000 right. done. And then it's kind of over?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For now, I should say.
Okay. How difficult is it to apply?
It's very easy. It's an online link. Mm-hmm. So parkcity.org, and look for the LivPC webpage, and there's a link right there to make application.
Right. And I guess what should people expect to see as a kind of a payout for, you know, not renting short term?
Our average has been 14 to 16% of value of the property. And I guess it's a consequence that both grants made so far is $200,000. One of the factors is that if you go over $200,000, we have to go before council. $200,000 can be approved in-house by city manager.
Okay, so that 14 to 16% you said is based on the assessed valuation of the house?
Yes. We get an appraisal completed before we make the final decision on amount and grant. And so, yes.
And then that $200,000 that was given kind of to the historic property owner, I mean, how different is that than from... We used to do those historic district grants.
Right. We still do historic district grants. But again, the purpose of this program is to keep people in year-round housing, to get people into year-round housing. And so when somebody receives the funding from this program, they're free to use it however they want. And this particular example, they used it to help make structural upgrades to their historic home.
Be nice to get just a small neighborhood to do it all, right? Because then they kind of know that they all have a neighborhood in the future, I guess. All right, so what do people need to do, again, if they're interested? I mean,
go to parkcity.org to look it up, and there's a webpage there. Also, they can contact me directly, Rhoda Stauffer, so rhoda.stauffer@parkcity.org. And I have set up two office hours times when people can come and just talk to me. So I will be in the Lucky Ones coffee shop this Friday morning from 9 to 11. And then again, Tuesday afternoon, April 9th, from 4 to 6.
At Lucky Ones again?
Yes.
Okay.
Even though Lucky Ones is closed, there's nice tables sitting there, and it's a perfect spot to sit and talk about the program.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to mention? Mm-hmm. Okay. Rhoda, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Summit County deputies took a man armed with a rifle into custody outside of South Summit High School yesterday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
Deputies with the Summit County Sheriff's Office responded to a 911 call about an alleged threat at South Summit High at about 7:30 in the morning Monday to find an upset man with a rifle yelling outside. Sheriff Sergeant Felicia Sotelo said the man with the gun was also the 911 caller, and he told deputies he believed a bomb may be inside the school.
He immediately put his firearm away and was safely taken into custody. He was escorted to the hospital to get the help that he needs.
Sotelo says no bomb was found and no one was injured Monday. South Summit students are on spring break and limited staff were at the high school that morning.
South Summit High School followed their protocol for these types of incidents and were very appreciative for them responding so quickly.
During the investigation, the school was locked down with no one allowed in or out. The Summit County Sheriff's Office gave the all clear around 9 a.m. Authorities haven't released the man's identity, but said he is not a Summit County resident. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
A child fell off the orange bubble chairlift at the Canyons Village side of Park City Mountain yesterday morning. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more about that.
Park City Mountain spokesperson Sarah Huey said a guest fell from the Orange Bubble Express around 9:15 a.m. Monday. Their condition is unknown. Huey couldn't share more details because the guest is a minor. A witness told KPCW the child was dangling from the lift as patrollers and other employees worked to set up a landing pad. The child fell an estimated 25 to 30 feet and landed partially on the pad, according to the witness. Other lift-related incidents have occurred at the resort in recent years. A Park City Mountain ski patroller died in January 2023 after a snow-covered tree fell on the shortcut lift at Canyons Village. Additionally, a family filed a lawsuit earlier this year alleging their daughter fell 30 feet off the Iron Mountain Express lift in 2020. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
It's 8:43. Good morning. Well, last year, the Park City Council funded the Child Care Scholarship Program with $1 million. On January 1st, the program launched, but to date, less than $25,000 has been awarded, and the city is looking to spread the word that funding is available. While some applications have been submitted and funded, there are still more than $900,000 for child care assistance that can be awarded. Park City resident advocate Michelle Downard is managing the program. She says they know there's a need for child care tuition, so they're not sure if word hasn't gotten out or whether the requirements to qualify may be too restrictive.
You know, it's hard to say because it is so new. And so I think we're going to let the program play out for just a little while, continue to update the council on the progress, and then revisit it when we think the time is right and when we have enough information.
A working group was established to help design program criteria using a recent assessment from the Early Childhood Alliance. The program is the only known program of its kind by a Utah municipality. In the first couple of months, Downard reports that 13 child care providers are actively participating in the program. 139 applications have been received. Of those, 69 were deemed incomplete. 28 were denied for not meeting the program thresholds. Either they exceeded the maximum income or their children aren't yet in a child care situation. 20 applicants came from people who live and work outside the Park City limits. Successful applicants must make less than 100% of the area median income, or AMI, which is about $148,000 for a family of four, be a resident of Park City, or work within the city limits or for the municipality. Downard says 23 households representing 25 children who meet the criteria have been enrolled.
You know, it's included all three of the eligibility criteria that you just mentioned. So everything from staff to residents and workforce. Again, it's still a little bit early to see strong trends from any of those, but we've seen participation from all the above.
The scholarship, she says, will provide for up to $1,700 a month per child. The family must provide 10% of their household income. The money is paid directly to the child care provider. At the March 14th Park City Council meeting, Downer recommended that the council wait to make any adjustments this early in the program. The Summit County Council has allocated $130,000 to support child care this year. Downard says they're discussing options to coordinate efforts as the county launches its program. The Park City Community Foundation is also establishing a joint task force to consider long-term child care industry stability. Parties involved include Summit County, the Park City Chamber, Park City School District, child care providers, parents, and other stakeholders. To find out more or to apply for child care assistance, you can see the link online at kpcw.org. On the phone now with an update from the Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Let's see, later this month, it's the annual Summit Land Conservancy's annual conservation breakfast, so people need to sign up now.
That's right. We're already over halfway full. We are so fortunate that the Deer Valley Resort hosts us for our annual conservation breakfast. This year it's happening on April 30th, which is a Tuesday, at 8:30 in the morning up at the Silver Lake Lodge. It costs $15. We ask people to go online and sign up. But it's a fabulous breakfast, again, because, you know, Deer Valley does a fabulous breakfast. And we're going to be talking about our first year of our For the Future Fund campaign and the milestones that we've hit and talk about what's coming up next. We're really excited because our guest speaker is Joel Ferry, and he is the executive director of the Utah Division of Natural Resources. So the Division of Natural Resources oversees the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, the Division of Agriculture and Food. So a lot of the things that we are involved in. Joel's a rancher, a farmer from Corinne, and has put his own land in a conservation easement. And I've really seen a lot of change at the state level in both the Division of Wildlife Resources and Division of Ag and Food since Joel has been at the helm. It's great to have a conservationist there as a partner.
Yeah, so plenty of parking there at Silver Lake Lodge?
We always encourage people to carpool, but there is parking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's at April 30th at that time, yeah.
Okay.
But people do need to sign up on our website, wesaveland.org, and I would encourage them not to dawdle because, as I said, we're already over halfway sold.
All right, and, you know, not to burst the bubble, but, I mean, when you say you're going to talk about the first year of For the Future, can you kind of give us any highlights?
You know, the year has I will just say what I'm saying about the first year of the For the Future campaign, it blew even my mind. And, you know, I'm to be pretty optimistic about things. So we had just tremendous success. And it's really because people just came out in droves and supported the work, our efforts to save more land and save it faster. So, yeah, I'd love to share the exciting news with people.
Okay. Let's see, you have another conservation win to report in the Camas Meadow.
That's right. So we announced just last month, a couple of weeks ago, that we concluded the Andrus conservation easement, and that is 96 acres in the Camas Meadow. And, you know, you look out in the Camas Meadow, and it's this big, wide, green area. And a lot of times you don't, you know, we wouldn't realize without looking at a plat map that it's kind of a jigsaw puzzle of ownership. But we're excited by this. It's the first in a basically a quilt of different landowners that are coming together to help save the important aquifer, the important natural resources right there in the Camas Meadows. The Andrus family, led by Irene Roof, has been wanting to do this conservation easement for over 10 years. Irene came into our office in 2011, actually, and said, I want to save our property. And at that time, we didn't have enough funding sources to do it. We knew that the federal funding sources, the Farm Bill programs that we use, would be interested in protecting that farmland, but there wasn't any other funding source to come to the table. So When the county's bond passed in 2021, that sort of had us sit up and take notice. And we thought, well, we need to call Irene right off the bat because now we have the possibility of doing this. And so I think it's kind of fitting that the first actual use of a conservation easement from the 2021 bond was the Andrus Farm. So we were able to use the county money. And then the other piece of that was the For the Future Fund, because there's always a gap. And again, it's the individual supporters that allow us to actually get these things across the finish line. So huge kudos to the Andrus family for their patience in waiting until the time was right so that we could help save their property.
Okay. What's going on with the Treasure Hill easement? We're going into 5 years at this point since city residents purchased that.
That's right. So the purchase agreement allowed for several years before the easement would be placed so that all the neighbors and various uses that had been discussed or permitted or prohibited on the property could all be clarified and written down and figured out. And then COVID happened and that slowed everything down. And then a real estate boom happened and that slowed everything down also because you know, there was a pretty extensive engineering study, title report, and survey, and that took an incredible amount of time just because it's a complicated property. Anyway, we are finally, I think, with a final draft of a conservation easement, and we plan to present that to City Council hopefully later this month.
Okay. Let's see. You are also partnering with the Swanna Preserve and Eco Center for a star party.
That's right. At Dark Skies. April is Dark Skies Month. And so we are excited to invite people out to Stevens Grove in Oakley, which is a really beautiful little natural public area that the Summit Land Conservancy helped to preserve. Swanna is going to come out there with us. Unfortunately, it's on April 8th, which is next Monday. It's sold out right now. You know, we don't charge for these things, but we do limit the number of people who can come because otherwise it just becomes too unwieldy. So right now it's sold out, but if people are interested, we encourage them to join the wait list because there's always last minute cancellations. So you can go to our website, wesaveland.org, and sign up for the Star Party wait list. And if somebody cancels or is not able to make it, then there's room for somebody else.
Okay, so you're going to do it, what, from the deck? Are you going to get out on snowshoes or what's?
Yeah, like we're going to get out there. So I would be prepared to wear, you know, with all the, there's no deck. We'll be at Stevens Grove in Oakley.
Oh, okay.
Not at Swanner. Yeah, it'll be out in Oakley. So, and it's so beautiful and quiet and deep out there. So, but I would encourage people definitely to wear winter attire for, getting out into the natural area.
All right. And you're already looking ahead to the summer months.
We're already looking ahead to the summer months. In addition to a whole lot of really great conservation that we hope to be doing, the Summit Land Conservancy's annual gala, the Blue Sky Bash, is on the calendar. So we hope that if people want to come, mark their calendars for Friday, August 9th at the Blue Sky Ranch out in Wanship. We're going to change things up, I think, a little bit with our entertainment. We've been talking a lot with Barb Phillips and Gracie's Foundation about doing a little bit of some horse entertainment, if you will, or getting to meet the horses a little bit, as well as then the regular fun and games with, we usually have squirt guns and raise some money to help us save that land and save it faster.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I think that about wraps it up.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Cheryl Fox, CEO of Summit Land Conservancy. Well, the Heber City Council will discuss a proposal that could bring more than 200 units of workforce housing to the city. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more on tonight's meeting.
Plans for the Celebration Workforce Housing Development include 230 units of affordable housing, 89 long-term hotel rooms, and retail space. It's expected to be built at the intersection of 400 East and 1200 South, near Wasatch High School and the Heber Valley Airport. Half the project's housing units will be townhomes and half will be apartments. The developer, Watts Enterprises, says the goal is to lease all units to essential county and city workers through a master lease program, including school district and hospital employees and first responders. The development will also include a daycare, grocery store, and community gathering spaces like fire pits and a swimming pool. Heber's Planning Commission made a positive recommendation for the development in August 2023. Now it's the City Council's turn to weigh in. They'll eventually need to change the zoning to permit the higher density development. Council members will offer feedback on the proposal during Tuesday's discussion, but no formal decisions will be made. Later, planners will come back to present a master development agreement. The agenda for Tuesday's meeting, plus a link to attend virtually, is available at kpcw.org. The work meeting begins at 4 p.m. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Park City Area Restaurant Association says that Savor the Summit will happen this June. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that organizers had previously said that those plans were up in the air.
In March, Savor the Summit organizers weren't sure the annual event could be held as they were working to finalize a new insurance agreement amid a personal injury lawsuit. A Park City summer tradition, Savor the Summit shuts down traffic and allows local restaurants to serve guests on tables spread up and down Main Street. Park City Restaurant Association, the feast's organizer, and Park City Municipal, which allows the event, are facing a legal complaint stemming from 2022. A Florida woman is seeking damages after suffering an injury during the dinner by falling into an uncovered utility access hole. The lawsuit is still active in 3rd District Court, but the Restaurant Association announced over the weekend that Savor the Summit will go on this summer. The event is scheduled for June 22nd. Reservations have to be made with specific restaurants, and costs vary. A list of participating eateries can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And the Park City Police Department is accepting applications to join this year's Citizens Police Academy. The new class begins May 1st and meets for 11 weeks on Wednesday evenings. Most meetings start at 6 o'clock and last a couple of hours. Officer Terry Knechtel runs the program and says it's a chance to see firsthand what officers do every day.
It's an opportunity for us every year to bring in members of the community so they can see what the professional law enforcement is like and hopefully answer questions that they may have. Despite the fact that what they see on TV and in movies, we're kind of just going to answer any question that they would have.
Participants must be 18 years or older without a serious criminal history and submit to a background check. Other sessions include training with the canine officer as well as the Summit County SWAT team.
We have a mock crime scene, and we'll take them through that crime scene on how we process it. We'll do incident command and fire and EMS so that they know that that's a resource that we use. This year, we're adding a drone class, so they get to see what the drones use and how it's used in the law enforcement community and what we use in the technology level. It's pretty involved.
Another session will involve a trip to the Utah Attorney General's office in Salt Lake City. There, participants get to use what's called the Virtra 360-degree screen training machine.
You're put in a scenario. You have a laser gun that shoots a laser beam, and you react to the scenario. And there's a gentleman from the Attorney General's office behind you that controls the scenario. We use it as a training tool. I use it as the ability to put people in that situation where we have a high level of stress or anxiety, and they get to experience a little bit of what we do.
Residents can apply online or stop by the police department's records division and pick up an application. There is no cost to participate. Well, major upgrades are proposed for two informal trailheads along Meadows Drive in Park City. Park City's Trail and Open Space Department is developing plans to build two new trailheads along the Farm and McLeod Creek trails near State Route 224. One would be established on the south side of Meadows Drive, adjacent to the Farm Trail, offering 19 parking spaces. Under the city's plan, the trailhead would be separated out from the roadway, allowing users to pull in, back out, and prepare outside of active traffic. The second trailhead would be located on the other side of SR 224, closer to the McLeod Creek Trail. It would have 11 parking spaces. Both trailheads would also include one ADA stall, kiosks with maps, and dogway stations. Additionally, the city plans to plow both parking lots during the winter. The City Council and Planning Commission still need to sign off on the project, but construction is scheduled to be completed this spring.